First Reforms. Chapter 4. Archbishop Albert. While Luther was thus preparing the way for one of the greatest revolutions that were destined to be effected in the Church, and the Reformation was beginning to enter powerfully into the lives of Christians, the Romish partisans, blind as those generally are who have long been in possession of power, imagined that, because Luther was in the warp, the Reform was dead and forever extinct, and fancied they should be able quietly to resume their ancient practices, that had been for a moment disturbed by the monk of Wittenberg. Albert, Elector Archbishop of Mentz, was one of those weak men who, all things being equal, decide for the truth, but who, as soon as their interest is put in the balance, are ready to take part with error. His most important aim was to have a court as brilliant as that of any prince in Germany, his equipages as rich, and his table as well furnished. The traffic and indulgences served admirable to obtain this result. Accordingly, the decree against Luther had scarcely issued from the imperial chancery, before Albert, who was then residing with his court at Halle, summoned the vendors of indulgences, who were still alarmed at the words of the reformer, and endeavored to encourage them by such language as this: "Fear nothing, we have silenced him. Let us begin to shear the flock in peace. The monk is a prisoner. He is confined by bolts and bars. This time he will be very clever if he comes again to disturb us in our affairs." The market was reopened, the merchandise was displayed for sale, and against the churches of Halle re-echoed with the speeches of the mountebanks. But Luther was still alive, and his voice was powerful enough to pass beyond the walls and gratings behind which he had been hidden. Nothing could have roused his indignation to a higher pitch. "What? The most violent battles have been fought. He has confronted every danger. The truth remained victorious. And yet they dare trample it underfoot, as if it had been vanquished. That voice shall again be heard, which has once already put an end to this criminal traffic. I shall enjoy no rest," wrote he to Spalatin, "until I have attacked the idol of Mentz with its brothel at Halle." Luther set to work immediately. He cared little about the mystery with which some sought to envelop his residence in the Wartburg. He was like Elijah in the desert forging fresh thunderbolts against the impious Ahab. On the 1st of November he finished his treatise against the new idol of Halle. Intelligence of Luther's plans reached the archbishop. Alarmed and in emotion at the very idea, he sent about the middle of October two of his attendants, Capito and Auerbach, to Wittenberg to avert the storm. "Luther must moderate his impetuosity," said they to Melanchthon, who received them cordially. But Melanchthon, although mild himself, was not one of those who imagine that wisdom consists in perpetual concession, tergiversation, and silence. "It is God who moves him," replied he, "and our age needs a bitter and pungent salt." Upon this Capito turned to Jonas, and endeavored through him to act upon the court. The news of Luther's intention was already known there, and produced great amazement. "What?" said the courtiers. "Rekindle the fire that we have had so much trouble to extinguish. Luther can only be saved by being forgotten, and yet he is rising up against the first prince in the empire. I will not suffer Luther to write against the Archbishop of Mentz, and thus disturb the public tranquility," said the elector. Luther was annoyed when these words were repeated to him. "Is it not enough to imprison his body, but they will also enchain his mind, and the truth with it? Do they fancy that he hides himself through fear, and that his retirement is an avowal of defeat? He maintains that it is a victory. Who dared stand up against him at Worms and oppose the truth?" Accordingly, when the captive in the Wartburg had read the chaplain's letter, informing him of the prince's sentiments, he flung it aside, determined to make no reply. But he could not long contain himself. He took up the epistle and wrote to Spalatin, "The elector will not suffer, and I too will not suffer the elector not to permit me to write. Rather would I destroy yourself, the elector, nay, the whole world forever. If I have resisted the Pope, who is the creator of your cardinal, why should I give way before his creature? It is very fine, forsooth, to hear you allow the everlasting peace of God to be disturbed, Spalatin. It shall not be so. Prince, it shall not be so. I send you a book I had already prepared against the cardinal when I received your letter. Forward it to Melanchthon." Spalatin trembled as he read this manuscript. Again he represented to the reformer how imprudent it would be to publish a work that would force the imperial government to lay aside its apparent ignorance of Luther's fate, and punish a prisoner who dared attack the greatest prince in the empire and the church. If Luther persevered in his designs, the tranquility would again be disturbed, and the Reformation perhaps be lost. Luther consented to delay the publication of his treatise. He even permitted Melanchthon to erase the most violent passages. But, irritated at his friend's timidity, he wrote to the chaplain, "The Lord lives and reigns, that Lord in whom you court folks do not believe, unless he so accommodate his works to your reason, that there is no longer any necessity to believe." He then resolved to write direct to the cardinal. It is the whole body of Romish bishops that Luther thus brings to the bar in the person of the German primate. His words are those of a bold man, ardent in zeal for the truth, and who feels that he is speaking in the name of God himself. "Your Electoral Highness," wrote he from the depth of the retreat in which he was hidden, "has set up again in Halle the idol that swallows the money and the souls of poor Christians. You think, perhaps, that I am disabled, and that the emperor will easily stifle the cries of the poor monk, but know that I shall discharge the duties that Christian charity has imposed upon me, without fearing the gates of hell, and much less the Pope, his bishops, and cardinals. For this reason my humble prayer is, that your Electoral Highness would remember the beginning of this affair, how a tiny spark kindled a terrible conflagration. All the world was at that time in a state of security. This poor begging friar, thought they, who unaided would attack the Pope, is too weak for such an undertaking. But God interposed, and he caused the Pope more labor and anxiety than he had ever felt since he had taken his place in the temple of God to tyrannize over the Church. This same God still lives, let none doubt it. He will know how to withstand a cardinal of Mentz, even were he supported by four emperors, for he is pleased above all things to hew down the lofty cedars and to abase the haughty pharaohs. For this reason I inform your highness by letter that if the idol is not thrown down, I must, in obedience to God's teaching, publicly attack your highness, as I have attacked the Pope himself. Let your highness conduct yourself in accordance with this advice. I shall wait a fortnight for an early and favorable reply. Given in my wilderness, the Sunday after St. Catherine's Day, November 15, 1521. From your Electoral Highness's devoted and obedient servant, Martin Luther." This letter was sent to Wittenberg, and from Wittenberg to Halle, where the cardinal-elector was then residing, for no one dared intercept it, foreseeing the storm that would be aroused by so daring an act. But Melanchthon accompanied it by a letter addressed to the prudent Capito, in which he endeavored to prepare the way for a favorable termination of this difficult business. It is impossible to describe the feelings of the youthful and weak archbishop on receiving the reformer's letter. The work announced against the idol of Halle was like a sword suspended over his head, and, at the same time, what anger must have been kindled in his heart by the insolence of his peasant's son, this excommunicated monk, who dared make use of such language to a prince of the House of Brandenburg, the primate of the German Church. Capito besought the archbishop to satisfy the monk. Alarm, pride, and the voice of conscience which he could not stifle, struggled fearfully in Albert's bosom. At last dread of the book, and perhaps remorse also, prevailed. He humbled himself. He put together all he thought calculated to appease the man of the Wartburg, and a fortnight had barely elapsed when Luther received the following letter, still more astonishing than his own terrible epistle. "My dear doctor, I have received and read your letter, and have taken it in good part. But I think the motive that has led you to write me such an epistle has long ceased to exist. I desire, with God's help, to conduct myself as a pious bishop and a Christian prince, and I confess my need of the grace of God. I do not deny that I am a sinner, liable to sin and error, sinning and erring daily. I am well assured that without God's grace I am worthless and offensive mire, even as other men, if not more so. In replying to your letter, I would not conceal this gracious disposition, for I am more than desirous of showing you all kindness and favor, for love of Christ. I know how to receive a Christian and fraternal rebuke. With my own hand, Albert." Such was the language addressed to the excommunicated monk of the Wartburg by the Elector Archbishop of Mentz and Magdeburg, commissioned to represent and maintain in Germany the constitution of the Church. Did Albert, is writing it, obey the generous impulses of his conscience, or his slavish fears? In the first case, it is a noble letter. In the second, it merits our contempt. We would rather suppose it originated in the better feelings of his heart. However that may be, it shows the immeasurable superiority of God's servants over all the great ones of the earth. While Luther alone, a prisoner and condemned, derived invincible courage from his faith, the archbishop, elector and cardinal, environed with all the power and favors of the world, trembled on his throne. This contrast appears continually, and is the key to the strange enigma offered by the history of the Reformation. The Christian is not called upon to count his forces, and to number his means of victory. The only thing he should be anxious about is to know whether the cause he upholds is really that of God, and whether he looks only to his master's glory. Unquestionably, he has an inquiry to make, but this is wholly spiritual. The Christian looks at the heart, and not the arm. He weighs the justice of his cause, and not its outward strength. And when this question is once settled, his path is clear. He must move forward boldly, were it even against the world and all its armed hosts, in the unshaken conviction that God himself will fight for him. The enemies of the Reformation thus passed from extreme severity to extreme weakness. They had already done the same at Worms, and these sudden transitions are of continual occurrence in the battle that error wages against truth. Every cause destined to fall is attacked with an internal uneasiness which makes it tottering and uncertain, and drives it by turns from one pole to the other. Steadiness of purpose and energy are far better. They would thus perhaps precipitate its fall, but at least if it did fall, it would fall with glory. One of Albert's brothers, Joachim I, Elector of Brandenburg, gave an example of that strength of character which is so rare, particularly in our own times. Immovable in his principles, firm in action, knowing how to resist when necessary the encroachments of the Pope, he opposed an iron hand to the progress of the Reformation. At Worms he had insisted that Luther should not be heard, and that he ought to be punished as a heretic, in despite of his safe conduct. Scarcely had the Edict of Worms been issued, when he ordered that it should be strictly enforced throughout his states. Luther could appreciate so energetic a character, and making a distinction between Joachim and his other adversaries, he said, "We may still pray for the Elector of Brandenburg." The disposition of this prince seemed to have been communicated to his people. Berlin and Brandenburg long remained closed against the Reformation. But what is received slowly is held faithfully. While other countries, which then hailed the gospel with joy, Belgium for instance, and Westphalia, were soon to abandon it, Brandenburg, the last of the German states to enter on the narrow way of faith, was destined in after years to stand in the foremost ranks of the Reformation. Luther did not read Cardinal Albert's letter without a suspicion that it was dictated by hypocrisy, and in accordance with the advice of Capito. He kept silence, however, being content with declaring to the latter that so long as the archbishop, who was hardly capable of managing a small parish, did not lay aside his cardinal's mask and episcopal pomp, and become a simple minister of the word, it was impossible that he could be in the way of salvation.